This audio is machine generated. Please excuse any mispronunciations.
Celebrating America's 250th and Keeping Jesus King by Steve Hinton.
Beyond doubt, in the annals of history, something profoundly different happened on July 4th, 250 years ago, when the 56 colonial delegates united their signatures to that piece of parchment, the Declaration of Independence. The history of America, and indeed the world, changed forever. In surveying pivotal points in history, the American Revolution always makes the list. And who can argue with the ramifications of that moment, with its ripple effects reaching around the globe today? The principle of deriving worth from God instead of status touches every aspect of life, from religion to law, from education to innovation, from commerce to humanitarian concerns. Yes, on July 4th, 1776, the world changed, driving humanity to a distant shore from which it will never return.
Could God have been involved in this profound transition? After all, the patriarch Job concluded that God makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and disperses them. Job 12:23, New IV. Benjamin Franklin, known more for deism, seemed to think so. As the young nation hung in the balance during the Constitutional Convention of 1787, it was Franklin who profoundly asserted, "I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men, and if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid?"
While people may wonder about such things as divine providence and the nation's founding, countless citizens will celebrate America's birthday this weekend. In small towns scattered across the map, simple parades will march down Main Street with wagons converted into papier-mâché floats pulled by John Deere tractors, hastily cleaned for the occasion. In larger metro areas, professional firms will fund parades with precision, and cities will launch thousands of dollars worth of fireworks to commemorate July 4th, 250 years ago. Yes, America will celebrate.
At the same time, growing voices of grumble will call a halt to the festivities and quickly point out the evil and error of American history. Yes, there is sin in our combined story, but it bothers me when people purposefully highlight the evil and ignore or even work to erase the good. It happened recently when a political journal, The Nation, ran an entire edition displaying every possible curse in the American journey. In a less than Christ-like fever, I retorted, "Were there problems over the past 250 years? Of course. But the fact that the national history they hate so much is the very one that gave them freedom of the press seems to have escaped their narrative."
Yes, I get it. There are chapters in American history that are a mixed bag. Yet as disciples of Jesus, what is the best way to respond to the past problems and present perils?
The answer typically varies depending on who currently holds the microphone. I regularly hear people say that ministers must preach on conservative moral issues such as abortion and same-sex marriage. From the other side of the landscape, I have had others beseech me that I must, if I am a true follower of Christ, preach on liberal moral issues, against systemic racial injustice and immigration enforcement, for example. Then, to top it off, some say I must do neither, but solely preach Christ crucified. In the confusion, I'm often reminded of Paul's admonition to keep your head in all situations, 2 Timothy 4:5, and this might be one such situation. The real questions for those who claim Christ are, what does the Bible say, and how can we live in the present age with a kingdom mindset? In a feeble attempt to do just that, let me offer 5 points to ponder and 5 challenges to chew on. Maybe these observations and questions will move us toward a more mature faith rather than allowing ourselves to be tossed around by the latest media highlight reels.
5 points to ponder. 1. America had a unique formation with a faith in the founders.
Many have debated whether America is a Christian nation or ever was one.
The answer depends on where your focus lies. Is America an official Christian state like Iran is an official Islamic state? No. However, to suggest that there were no Christian roots embedded in the minds of the founders would be historically and academically irresponsible.
Part of the uniqueness of the American Revolution lies in its comparison with the French and Russian revolutions. In both of those occasions, the state was elevated over the individual, and human reason was prioritized over divine revelation. The fruits of the French Revolution were the guillotine, the Reign of Terror, and additional revolutions, with the second ushering in the reign of Napoleon. The Russian Revolution led to the murder of the Tsar and his children and set off the world's first atheistic state, the Soviet Union, and eventually the murder of an estimated 6 to 20 million people under Stalin, depending on how you categorize the various body counts. The offspring of America was different because the founders operated out of a worldview heavily influenced by Christianity. While some of them were indeed deists, they were by no means complete atheists. Thomas Jefferson himself, who is lauded as a hero by many atheists, is the one who wrote into the preamble to the Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." The entire basis for this rise in New World thought came from an understanding that our value, worth, and thus potential come from God. In scouring the writings of the Founding Fathers, we see this faith, though not always perfect, repeatedly expressed in their thinking. In his farewell address to the nation, George Washington stated that reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can exist apart from religious principle. The second president, John Adams, instructed that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Yes, there was something unique about the formation of America. When contrasted with other revolutions, we see the distinction was not, first and foremost, human reason, which other revolutions claimed as well, but a heritage grounded in divine revelation. 2. It is good that we celebrate the good. Paul admonished the church to give honor where honor is due, Romans 13:7, and James notes that every good and perfect gift is from the Father above, James 1:17. The blessings that permeate the texture of the American story certainly fall into this category. Maybe this is why I get hot and bothered when people only complain about America. I acknowledge there are profound issues in our history. However, compared to world history, the blessings that have arisen from America are mammoth. An unbiased historical study of America will show a higher rate of education, even among the poor, than was in Europe and certainly on other continents. Higher wages than in Europe were the norm for the average worker in the U.S. Religious freedom was a keystone, and humanitarian service has always been a hallmark. In school, I learned that Georgia was established as a penal colony. What I only later picked up was that the founder, James Oglethorpe, sought to create a place for those in debtors' prison in England to make a fresh start. Yes, later arrivals in Georgia eventually turned to the slave trade, but that was not the case at its founding. The list goes on, and we must reconcile with the reality that so many of the freedoms and blessings we have inherited today are the fruit of those who have gone before us who were influenced by biblical truth. 3. It is God who ordained governmental order. In Romans 13, 1-7, Paul forthrightly declares that God establishes governments, and the general reason is for the maintaining of order. Local traffic laws are illustrative of this principle. The rub at times, though, is in defining what maintaining order looks like. The more liberal interpretation would call for the government to provide for our needs and thus ensure tranquility. The more conservative understanding is that the authorities merely keep the bad guys off the streets and leave the law-abiding citizens alone. From this premise that God establishes government, two responsibilities flow. We see the first one again in Romans 13, where Paul states that we are to obey the laws of the land, Romans 13:1. Jesus taught us to pay taxes when mandated, to give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God, Luke 20:25, NIV. The only exception we see to this command is when authorities call us to disobey God, such as in Acts chapter 4, where Peter and John refuse the Sanhedrin's demand that they cease preaching in the name of Christ. Acts 4:12-20. The second responsibility for disciples of Jesus is seen in 1 Timothy, where Paul urged us to pray for kings and all those in authority. See 1 Timothy 2:1-5. We can assume that praying for the salvation of our leaders is in play here, But the point of this appeal seems to hinge on our society's ability to live peaceful and quiet lives. Living in such a community makes it easier to proclaim Christ than when we are living in seasons of chaos.
4. We are free to participate in government. Thinking of the Nation Journal again, I noted one of their articles titled "Separation of Church and State, America's Best Idea," and am reminded of how often this phrase is misunderstood and misapplied. The problem is that many assume the phrase appears in the Constitution, which it never does. The oft-quoted slogan is linked to Thomas Jefferson in a letter he wrote to the Danbury Baptist Association of Connecticut in 1802, assuring them that the federal government would not endorse a national church, as England had done. Here, Jefferson cited a Puritan minister, Roger Williams, who founded the Providence Colony in 1636. It was Williams who wrote of a high wall between church and state to keep the wilderness of governments out of the affairs of religion. In other words, the objective was to protect the church from the government and not the other way around. The exception to this rule would be along the lines of a specific Christian denomination or other religious system, like Islam, bent on subjugating the rest of the nation under its particular authority.
The actual text of the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights states, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." The entire goal was to avoid a federal state church, not to remove God from the public sector or politics. Thus, the law in America does not prevent anyone from participating in politics, even when they are motivated by their faith. We see from Scripture that Paul employed his own Roman citizenship to further the gospel, Acts 22:27-29. The only true question is one of conscience and motive. Paul noted in 1 Corinthians 10:31 that in whatever we do, it should be done for the glory of God. So, if someone feels compelled to enter the political fray and can do so in love, then I'd say they have a green light.
5. We must hold Christ as High King in our hearts. For 2 years, I served as a missionary in the former Soviet Union. I saw the dreadful aftermath of an intentionally godless system on the individual soul and society. However, I also know where the real power of transformation comes from, and it is not politics. In our most glorious moments, we must remember this. At a critical juncture in the American story, on December 1, 1862, President Lincoln touched on America's potential while failing to remember its source of hope. In his concluding remarks for the annual message to Congress, he proclaimed America to be the last best hope of earth, a phrase used by subsequent presidents. But the statement is not true. Is America the best and most hopeful political system on the planet today? I personally would completely affirm that thesis, but the greatest hope is found only in a transformed heart by Jesus.
Let's be honest. Many of the issues debated in our culture revolve around selfishness. When this is the case, politics cannot solve the deeper problems, no matter how enlightened they are. The answer is found only in a changed heart, which is why Jesus came. The transformed person then naturally begins to do what is good, regardless of law.
I have said for years that Christians ought to be the best citizens in America. When more people act from a changed heart toward the betterment of others, one does not need more laws. That is what is found ultimately in Christian awakening and revival. That must be our first and foremost aim.
5 challenges to chew on. 1. Am I walking with balance or on the road of personal preference?
When we enter political discussions, it is important to remember that we do not normally have all the facts or all the pieces of the story. To continually stump for what we desire without considering someone else's plight does not foster unity. To quote one of my favorite non-American statesmen, Winston Churchill, "Courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen."
2. Am I doing something practical or just screaming slogans?
It's one thing to petition and vote for pro-life legislation, and it's another thing to support a crisis pregnancy center in your community. On the other end of the social debate, it's easy to champion humanitarian assistance to the poor, while it's quite another to actually take cash out of your own bank account to help instead of expecting the government to foot the bill.
3. Am I as serious about obeying and praying as I say I am?
If the truth be told, many of the laws that rub us wrong don't necessarily contradict the Bible. We just don't like them. So we must ask if we are truly putting Christ first and respecting the laws of the land we reside in, or just the convenient ones. What about praying for those in office, even when we don't agree with them? I remember years ago wrestling with this issue, and at the time, the only prayer I could muster up was, "Lord, please deliver this person from the evil one." I don't know if that was perfect, but at least I was praying. 4. Am I making my issues their issues?
I gravitate toward marriage and family issues. Those are personal to me. But other Christians are more passionate about different concerns. We all have struggles that are hot buttons for us, but not for others. We can't assume our social issues are God-mandated for everyone. The range of social topics is as wide as the Atlantic Ocean that the pilgrims crossed on the Mayflower for religious freedom. One or many of those issues may have a strong place in your heart. If so, then do what you can to bring healing and answers. But that does not necessarily mean it is God's individual calling for everyone to be just as passionate about.
5. Am I honestly investing first in Christ and His kingdom? We say that Jesus is King, but how does that play out in daily life? As we celebrate America, maybe we can also take stock of who is genuinely in authority. Consider your calendar and cash. How much of my time and agenda is owned by the culture around us? And how much is led by Jesus? With our finances, are we paying more tax to America than we are in our tithes and offerings? I once heard a preacher calculate that if every person in America who claimed Christ truly tithed, the church would have enough money to solve world hunger immediately and still have millions of dollars left over. I believe he's right.
Yes, I believe we should rightly celebrate the blessings of America. However, for those of us who know Christ, we must be intentional to put Him first in all matters of life. I remember of one of my not-so-wise early moves in ministry, attempting to convey the primacy of Christ above all else in what I believe to be a small but profoundly symbolic action. The setting was a church whose origins date near the Civil War. Like many traditional churches of that age, they adorned their stage with both the American and Christian flag. The issue is priority of position. As a Boy Scout, I learned flag etiquette and the procedure of placing the flag of authority on the right side of the podium. Thus, the American flag will always be on the speaker's right and the state flag on the left. So, what of situations when the Christian flag is displayed? Often the pattern is the same, with the American on the right and the Christian on the left. Thus, the message conveyed is that the American flag takes precedence over the Christian flag. To illustrate my point, I deliberately changed the positions of the two flags to the annoyance of the elderly.
As a young preacher in my late 20s, was that worth my going to the mat on in a church with World War II and Korean War veterans? Probably not. Yet is this a serious point to ponder? I believe so. I believe we wrestle with this tension honestly.
As Christians in America, it is good to honor the sacrifice of those who have gone before us and acknowledge the blessings we have inherited because of them. Above all else, though, we must cling to Christ as the ultimate answer. That is why I often pray for awakening and revival. After all, the beautiful pieces of the society we now call the United States arose from such an awakening.
What will historians make of America 250 years from now? More importantly, what will future generations say of the Christians who lived in America in 2026? Will they say, as Jesus hoped, that they were known by their love, John 13:35, above their patriotism?
For now, let us say, Happy Birthday, America.
Let us regularly say, Thank you, Jesus, for the spiritual freedom He alone gives.
Above all, let us shout that hope from the hills.
For footnotes, see this article at renew.org.
For more from Steve, see kingdomology.com.